A child speaks to his parents. Give me food to nourish me, warmth and comforting, secure in your love. Things change so quickly and appear so strange. Let me enjoy my five senses. Give me plenty of things to handle, to feel, to smell, to touch, to hear, and some that I may break. Let me try out my new powers as my body develops, to sit, to creep, to stand, to walk, to climb, and jump when I am ready. Don't mix up the natural needs of my body with your emotions or mind. Don't make me experience too much, too long. Do not punish me for being angry when I have been disappointed or deprived. It's bad enough as it is. Speak to me with your heart and your hands. I do not understand your words. Surround me with kindly people. Give me peace in which to grow. Give me a corner of your home, all my own. Give me my share of attention and consideration. Let me question. Give me an honest answer, as you know. Let me experiment. Let me find out things for myself. Let me stay sensitive to beauty. Let me have fun out of little things, no matter how foolish they may seem to you. Encourage my efforts to do things, even when I do not do them very well. Let me share responsibilities. Measure them out to me according to my size. Let me play, and so let me tell you how I am trying to work out the problems I am up against. When you tell me to do this and that, tell me why. Let me feel that I am wanted, that I am important to you. Include me in the family plans when you can. Be friendly and loyal to me that I may know how to be the same to others. Prove to me that a promise is a promise. Please don't keep me your baby when I want to feel grown up. Don't make me afraid of losing your love. Don't implant your own fears in me. My own are difficult enough for me to handle. Help me to feel the difference between make-believe and reality. Help me not to act when I'm angry, but don't make me so afraid of being angry that I lose my capacity to feel strongly. Let me learn, bit by bit, to bear pain, to want, and to postpone. Let me learn to look forward to pleasures that are really coming. In tonight's seminar, we're going to look at child abuse. For a variety of reasons, all parents and caregivers will experience stress or anger while caring for children. Some may have so many stresses and problems of their own that they simply can't cope. Others may have difficulty in controlling their behaviour. In both cases, feelings may spill over into actions that may hurt or harm the child. This seminar is designed to give parents and caregivers, in fact, all of us who are involved in caring for children, a better understanding of what child abuse is, how it can occur, what can be done to protect children, how to help abuse children, and what to do if you are abusing your child. Let's start with the four dimensions of abuse: intellectual, emotional, spiritual, which is social, and physical. A definition. Here it is on the overhead. Emotional abuse is behaviour by a parent or caregiver which destroys children's confidence in themselves. Some examples. Children continually rejected and shown little or no attention. Children constantly told that they are no good or worthless. 60 years ago, a baby was born in Red Range, and due to complications in the birth, a doctor was called in to attend the delivery. The doctor travelled from Glen Innes to Red Range, some 24 miles for the round trip, in a horse-drawn vehicle. The doctor's fee for the day was a staggering £5. The infant's father had to pay it off in monthly 1 pound instalments. The child was repeatedly reminded of this during his childhood with statements such as, "I shouldn't have paid the 5 pounds and then the doctor could have repossessed you." 60 years later, this fellow still cannot see the humorous side of this story. Secondly, is children subjected to constant verbal abuse and threats. Children punished by being locked up alone or not allowed to have friends or social activities. Emotional abuse can harm children, such as other forms of abuse, just the same sorts of way. Emotional abuse can be difficult to identify because it doesn't leave any physical injuries. Often it goes unrecognized until the child shows signs of emotional problems, changes in behavior, being aggressive, lying, stealing, destructive or violent behavior, constantly seeking attention, body rocking, sucking things, being withdrawn, depressed. Of course, these same signs can indicate other forms of abuse. Later on in the seminar, we will talk about what we can do about abuse. Just for the present, we're just identifying the forms of abuse. Okay? So that's emotional abuse. Secondly, we'll look at intellectual abuse. Let's start with the definition. Intellectual abuse is any behavior by a parent or caregiver which hinders or limits a child's capacity to learn, or which feeds an immature mind with inappropriate stimulation. Thank you. Newsweek magazine, 7th of October 1983, page 81. It stated that prolonged TV viewing is a form of child abuse, a diet that causes severe intellectual malnutrition. Not talking to your child or talking down to your child, failing to read to your child or allowing him to read for himself are possible forms of intellectual abuse. Feeding a child on inappropriate or false information may also be a form of intellectual abuse. From the supposedly harmless white lie to the fact that children are not born but bought by the stork or found under a gooseberry bush. From the exposure to violent TV cartoons to the triple X-rated video or the magazine left for the child to view, these are forms of intellectual abuse. Spiritual or social abuse. Australian Women's Weekly of January the 27th, 82, featured an article entitled "The Lure of the Cults." Although this article is primarily about the Unification Church, derisively known as the Moonies after their founder, Reverend Sung Mung Moon, this article explores the social problem of spiritual abuse. The tremendous rise in the number of psychiatrists and other health professionals moving into the field of cult deprogramming reveals the effectiveness of such abuse through brainwashing techniques. Although not all cults hang around airports waiting to lure lonesome foreign travellers into their ranks, forcing a child or any person to believe in exclusive doctrinal bias, or equally harmfully, to isolate anyone from any form of moral or principled instruction, is spiritual or social abuse. Our social society, our structure, is based on an accepted moray, vital to the functioning of that society. Proponents of amoral, note I said amoral, not immoral, amoral society, such as A.S. Neil Summerhill School, are considered by many as abusers of the spiritual and social rights of the child. Despite the fact that many school playgrounds are arenas for desocialization due to the tactless ostracism of racially, physically, socially, or intellectually different children, to deny any child social intercommunication and the development of friendships is child spiritual or social abuse. The harsh reality is that bigotry of children towards those different to themselves is often a reflection of the parental or caregiver's ideology. To develop a socially well-adjusted adult, a child needs the opportunities to develop as a well-adjusted child social being. Notwithstanding the parental control over the choice of a child's friends, which is best controlled by the education of the child on the choice of friends rather than condemnation of those considered undesirable, every child needs the opportunity to develop healthy friendships as an integral part of their social development. So here we have our definition of spiritual or social abuse. It's any behaviour by a parent or caregiver which limits or hinders a child's potential for natural, holistic, social and spiritual development. Dr. Sula Wolf highlights the social implications of social spiritual abuse in her book Children Under Stress. On page 223, she makes this observation. Let me read. Recovery from gross deprivation or distortion of socialization process in early life takes away many years. It is not surprising that society has not yet found a way of meeting adequately the treatment needs of these children. Actually, she's also critical of the potential for parental deprivation in solo parent situations, placing the blame on selected parents who, because of a confrontation with the other parent, deprive the child of any contact with adults of that sex. In this context, she describes the broken home as an index of parental and societal deprivation, page 108. This situation is compounded in unions between homosexuals where a child is being raised by two, quote, parents of the same sex. Dr. Bruce Bishop, senior lecturer in social education at the University of New England in Armidale, says, every child is unique and seeks in his own or her relations with others to find ways of being recognized as special by the significant people in his or her life. Every child needs to feel secure and therefore needs to feel able to cope with societal situations. When children produce problem behaviours, they are not merely telling us that all is not well with them. In a radio broadcast, ABC Radio, transcript of which appears in the book About Children, Dr. Bishop detailed that when adults begin to feel the strain of living, they react through headaches, eczema, insomnia, the inability to relax. Children, however, react through attention-seeking, confrontation, revenge, and helplessness. So a third type of form of abuse is that of spiritual or social abuse. Let's move on to probably the most well-known or most easily recognized form of abuse, physical abuse. Actually, this takes many forms. Neglect, misapplied discipline, anger transference, sexual abuse, and physical trauma. Actually, we might look at this one first. Here's our definition. Physical abuse is any non-accidental injury or pattern of injuries to a child that endangers or impairs the child's physical or emotional health and development. Examples of this kind of abuse would be when the children are deliberately beaten, shaken. Yes, it's not okay to shake babies, according to a specially prepared pamphlet put out by NAPCAN, that's the National Association for the Prevention of Child Abuse and Neglect. So let me say this again. When children are deliberately beaten, shaken, when a child is burnt, cut, poisoned, choked, tied up, held underwater, given alcohol, other drugs. These are physical trauma. Like most forms of child abuse, physical abuse occurs in all societies, in all cultural groups in our society. Child abuse is not usually an isolated incident of a non-accidental injury. It's more often a pattern of behaviour occurring over a period of time, and the longer it goes on, the more serious the effects on the victims, the family and the community. Discipline. Signs of the Times, November 78, page 20. Child psychology, says a child psychologist, always works best when applied like paint, that is, with a brush. I mentioned earlier misapplied discipline. Many parents do not realise when physical punishment is inappropriate. I say parents, of course, this equally applies to teachers, caregivers, and disciplinary service personnel. Often adults who survived, presumably, harsh punishment as a child may claim it didn't do me any harm. There's a fine line between hitting a child and causing physical injury to a child, particularly when a child is small and spindly built. Many people don't realise how easily children can be hurt, or that violently shaking of a child may cause brain damage in children or death to an infant. As a rule, parents need to be authoritative rather than authoritarian, to know when to say no. Elizabeth Weiss says, "A reasonable, rational parent with a firm convictions is a more worthy model than someone who resorts to rule by force." Anger. Anger transference is another form of physical abuse and is possibly the most common of all the physical abuses, excepting sexual abuse. In other words, with the exception of sexual abuse, most physical abuse occurs when the parent or the caregiver is angry and loses control. Suggestions for controlling these situations are going to be dealt with in a later part of the segment of our seminar. However, there are a few danger signals to alert you to possible situations where the potential for hurting your child may occur. Number one, feeling out of control anger, feeling like hitting your child. Two, threatening to hurt your child. Three, feeling lonely and isolated and in danger of lashing out. Neglect. Unlike other forms of abuse, neglect is more about what a parent or caregiver does not do rather than what he or she does. Let's start with a definition. It is cute, isn't it? All right. Neglect is a continual failure to provide a child with the basic necessities of life. Well, what are the basic necessities of life? Food, clothing, shelter, emotional security, medical and dental care, adequate supervision when needed for the child's proper growth and development. In understanding neglect, it's important to be sensitive to cultural and society differences. We mustn't assume that a child is neglected just because the family does not live up to our standards. Neglect is usually caused by a complex mixture of personal, family, social and cultural factors. For example, poverty may cause neglect in its legal definition, but people do not neglect their children just because they're poor. Just as many children from poor homes are loved and well cared for, just as there are many children from wealthier families who are abused and neglected. Neglect also implies situations where poisons or alcohol or other drugs or dangerous implements are left lying around where children may be at risk due to their presence. Neglect presents itself in seven basic ways. Here it is here. Number one, low self-esteem. The child may be anxious and fearful due to an unpredictable environment with little or no assurance that his or her basic needs will be met. Number two, insufficient or inappropriate clothing. Climactic changes affect children as well as adults, well, probably maybe more. Inappropriate or insufficient clothing for the weather is an indicator of potential neglect. If you feel warm and comfortable, then maybe your child may be too. If you're feeling a little bit nippy, have a glance at what your child is wearing. Number three, low achievement. A child may progressively develop learning deficits due to a high level of disorganisation within the family and its consequent lack of support or lack of sleep or irregular school attendance, poor nutrition, etc. Which actually brings us to number four, which is a failure to thrive. A failure to thrive is a condition in which the child suffers inadequate weight gain, which may result in severe growth and developmental problems. Actually, this is often caused by a combination of poor nutrition and a lack of proper emotional care of the child. Of course, education has got a lot to do with this too, doesn't it? Another indicator, number five, a failure to obtain necessary medical or dental attention. It's similar to number six, a lack of supervision. By a lack of supervision, we're referring to that which is appropriate to the age of the child. For example, being unprotected from electrical or other hazards around the home, being left unsupervised without adequate age-appropriate care and attention. Of course, there are extreme situations when this lack of adequate care may continue for several days at a time. I visited one home in New Zealand where the young children had been locked in the house with insufficient food and no supervision whatsoever for quite a number of days until the parents were able to be located by neighbours. We've got one other common indicator of possible neglect, and that's behavioural problems. This is when the child appears restless, apathetic, depressed or withdrawn, or may display excessive attention-seeking behaviours. This brings us now to sexual abuse, sexual assault. We'll start with a definition. Child sexual assault is, quote, any behaviour, comment or exposure which involves an older person using his or her power over the child to involve the child in any form of sexual activity. Now, there's a lot of myths about sexual abuse, sexual assault. And before talking to children about sexual assault, it's important for adults to know the facts and to realise that many of the things that people say about child assault are actually wrong. Let me just suggest a few for you. Stranger danger is the problem. Well, stranger danger is not the main problem. In 85% of the cases, the offender is a member of the child's immediate family or someone the child knows and trusts, a parent, relative, older friend or neighbour. The victim is usually a teenage girl. Well, girls and boys of all ages are sexually assaulted, and victims are sometimes toddlers, young children, even babies. Another myth is that sexual assault on children occurs only in poor or problem families. Well, it occurs in all kinds of families, rich, poor, small, large, well-educated or not. Another one is children lie about sexual assault or imagine it's happening. Well, children rarely lie about or imagine sexual assault. In a report that was made just recently, 98% of cases, statements were found to be true. Another myth is that if a child is sexually assaulted, it usually happens once only, and that's it. Some cases can go on for years, because the offender is often the person who can easily arrange to be left alone with the child. It's more common for sexual assault to be repeated, repeated, repeated. Another myth is that sexual assault of children usually involves violence. Well, that's another myth, because it seldom involves violence, because offenders are usually known to a child. They don't need to use force. Instead, they use promises, threats, bribes. They take advantage of the fact that the child is powerless. Well, what are some of the reasons for abuse? Let's list some on the blackboard, shall we? I'll just suggest here that we stop and think about this. Reasons are triggers to abuse, and they're not excuses. Okay, there are no excuses for abuse. Okay, all right. Parents with no supports and under a lot of stress can take it out on the kids. All right, we're looking for triggers. Isolation. When there is no one to help, the heavy demands of children, problems seem worse. Yes, that's right. Okay, stress. It's a good one. Financial, job, medical problems, family members with a physical or intellectual disability, lack of communication between parents. Stress. It's a good one, isn't it? Yes, unrealistic expectations. Parents expect children to be like little adults. They don't know about child development sometimes, do they? Yes, that's a good one. Lack of parenting skills. Sort of flows on with what I was saying about child development, doesn't it? Parents don't know how to discipline kids, and they sometimes have no models of successful families. That's right, sometimes the case, isn't it? Yes, that's right. Poor childhood experiences. There's a cycle sometimes where many abusive adults were treated badly as children. Yes, drug and alcohol problems. These limit the ability to care for children properly, don't they? Yes, immaturely. Immaturity. Yeah, I'm not spelling it right, am I? Immaturity. Sometimes very young children are insecure because their parents themselves are insecure. They can't understand the child's behaviour and needs. I'll leave this list on the blackboard. We're going to use it again in a moment. Okay, you remember I said that these reasons are not excuses? There are no excuses for child abuse. We sometimes hear them though, don't we? I'd like to glean some information from the Child Protection Council booklet, No Excuses, Never Ever. Here's some excuses. All fathers do this. Well, what's the attitude here? Underlying this excuse is the attitude that children are their father's property. While our society no longer accepts the view of women as the property of their husbands, the ideas of ownership of children and parents' absolute rights over children are still strong. The offender uses these common attitudes to excuse his behaviour by claiming that all fathers do this. He also tries to trick the child into thinking no crime has been committed, and that there's nothing unreasonable about his demands. Another excuse that fathers sometimes make. Well, I'm just giving you some sex education. Actually, it's not just fathers, it's uncles, grandfathers, and other relatives who sexually assault children. Taking advantage of the child's trust, they pretend to be doing something of benefit for the child, when in fact they're only acting from selfish motives. Another excuse is, my wife is frigid or ill, pregnant, or my wife goes out to work. This excuse relies on one of society's popular myths about male sexuality, that men's sexual urges are uncontrollable and that it is a wife's responsibility to see to it that her husband's sexual needs are met so that he's not, quote, forced to turn elsewhere, for example, to his own children. This excuse neatly shifts the blame for the crime of sexual abuse from the offender to his wife. Another excuse is, the child's to blame. He or she led me on. And it's surprising how many people are inclined to believe this excuse. It's commonly used by offenders when referring to very young girls, not just in relation to teenage or adolescent girls. It's also being used increasingly about boys who are accused of being streetwise or asking for it. With this excuse, the offender refuses to accept responsibility for his actions and even goes to the extent of blaming the child. Children are sexual beings and sometimes behave flirtatiously. Often they are copying adult behaviour, believing it will gain them attention and affection. They're not seeking an adult sexual response and can never be blamed if an adult involves them in inappropriate sexual activity. The adult is responsible and not the child. Another excuse is, I was just showing some affection. By using this excuse, the offender is claiming to be unable to tell the difference between sexual and non-sexual affection and between appropriate and inappropriate behaviour toward children. This excuse is used to play down the seriousness of the assault and also to confuse and trick the child into thinking everything's all right. This is part of a common pattern of deception and abuse of trust when a child sexual assault involves relatives or other people the child looks up to. Here's another excuse. It's our special game. Another example of the abuse of trust involved in child sexual assault. The offender realizes the importance of deceiving the child into thinking that nothing's wrong. This deception makes it easier to overcome the child's objections, and to maintain secrecy. Another excuse is, the child's mother is to blame. She should have known about it, or she should have stopped it. Quite a lot of people share the underlying attitude which leads the offender to make this excuse. The underlying attitude is that women somehow know instinctively, or should know instinctively, if they are, quote, good mothers, when their children are in danger or need protecting. Offenders often use this excuse to avoid responsibility for their own actions and to pass the blame onto someone else and perpetuate the myth. Another excuse is, didn't do any harm. Child sexual assault is known to have many harmful effects, which victims need help and support to overcome. The harmful effects are not always easy to detect, and sometimes only appear in later life. By claiming that no harm is done by child sexual assault within the family, the offender hopes to deny the crime and reject any suggestion of blame or responsibility. What to do if? We come to this time in our seminar where we're going to think about what we can do if we're about to hit our child. Now, you should have a handout for this. We've got two segments we're going to look at. What to do if you're abusing your child, and if you're the spouse or relative of a friend of abuse, and if through your association you come across the recipient of information relating to or suspecting child abuse. But firstly, let's have a look at this list of reasons we've got on the blackboard. What can abuser or potential abusers, but these are only triggers, remember, these are only triggers to abuse and not excuses. What can the abuser do in each of these cases? Okay, and you've got an overhead, and you've also got a handout. But I'll just run through a few quickly. Just check and make sure your child is safe first. Then stop. Step back, sit down. Take 5 deep breaths, slowly, slowly. Count to 10, or better yet, 20. Telephone a friend or a relative. Have a cup of tea or coffee, or decaffeinated, that's what I would prefer or recommend. Still angry? Well, some suggest punching a pillow. Maybe hugging a pillow wouldn't be such a bad idea. Thumb through a magazine, a book, photo album, newspaper. Try some sit-ups. Pick up a pencil and write down your thoughts or the grocery list. Take a bath or a shower. Lie down on the floor or just put your feet up. Try singing. Put on your favourite music. Water your plants. Put your child in a stroller. Go for a walk. Well, these are transitional remedies, temporary. What do we do in the long run? Well, let's look at how we can stop abusing a child. What is a person to do if he realizes that he is abusing a child? Now look, these are my personal suggestions. These are known to be effective through years of research and application in actual practice. You won't find these listed in contemporary literature. However, these suggestions are known to work if you're prepared to give them a try. Number one, admit that you have abused your child. And sometimes the acknowledging helps in itself. Number two, realize that you are not alone in this problem, but you must take steps to stop. Number three, ask forgiveness. Go to the child if he's old enough to understand. Try to explain your actions. Remember, excuses are not acceptable, but reasons may help your child to understand. Remember this, wounds will heal if you dress them with love. If you're a Christian, ask your God for forgiveness. Scripture assures us we have forgiveness the instant we ask for it. 1 John 1:9 in the New English Bible says, if we confess our sins, he is just and may be trusted to forgive our sins and to cleanse us from every kind of wrong. For the Christian also, prayer and meditation upon the Word of God will do wonders for you and for your child. Number four, reassess your values. course, here the Christian has a distinct advantage, as an act of sincere religious life will bring you to a deep sense of values and value. However, all of us are able to assess values in terms of what is right and wrong, and ponder on the advice of our own parents, teachers, mentors, and any significant other in our lives. Pondering on these things can do little but good in reassessing our value system for good. Number 5, ask for help. If your child is driving you up the wall and you fear you may lose control, call an understanding relative or friend, even a babysitter if necessary. Inquire at your local Citizens Advice Bureau or community centre about parent support groups. Number 6, talk to your minister, rabbi, priest, counsellor. Ask for his or her sympathetic encouragement as you start a new life. And number 7, to seek the assistance of a professional counsellor or psychologist, social worker, etc. This is vitally important if the abuse has resulted in serious injury or death, or if sexual abuse is involved. When I was debriefing counsellors after the Newcastle earthquake, I encouraged them to say to the people they were counselling, and the same applies when you have been abusing your child. This is what I suggested. Nothing can change the past. Your choices steer the present. You can control the future. And now, what are you to do if you're the spouse or the friend or a relative of an abuser? I'll talk briefly about the spouse's position first and discuss friends and relatives in a moment when we look at recipients of information about child abuse. Number 1, help the abused child. We're going to discuss this in our second part of our seminar in depth. Second, become a companion to your spouse. Now, you should have a handout there entitled Companionship. And this lists 10 commandments, if you like, for companionship. They are to be interested in your mate's interests, have interests of your own, recognise and accept fatigue in a mate, reach decisions together, laugh together, tell the truth, feel the joy of joyfulness, share in creativity, share your faith, and be sexually companionable. Now, if you're a relative or friend or spouse, there are some other things you can do. You can help by listening to the children's worries. Talk to them about their problems. If you're a friend or a relative, you can give the parent a break, asking what you can do to help. You can report the abuse if necessary. Remember, accusations and criticism destroy, support and understanding build up. And support does not mean to condone or excuse abuse. A support person empathises, not sympathises. In fact, the Child Protection Council, and you should have a copy of this as a handout also, they have put out a fact sheet. It is their fact sheet number 2, and it's reporting suspected child abuse. They have headings such as why reporting is important, who should report, how to report, listening to children, signs and symptoms of abuse, and notificational procedures. This ends the first part of our seminar, and now we will move on to look at how to talk to children about abuse. The master gardener once said, "Suffer the little pansies to grow in my garden." Then he handed me the spade. "Take care till I return." "But God, I don't know how. I've never had a pansy. They're so tiny, so frail." "Trust me with a rose. The thorns will protect it from my clumsiness." "Trust me with a tulip, safely buried beneath the sod till spring forth a new blossom after a season of hardship." "Trust me with an ivy vine whose tendrils will cling to others to support." "But God, not a pansy. They've no thorns, no bulb, no vine. Don't trust me with them." But the gardener would not listen. So I changed my prayer. "Okay, God, I'll care for the pansies, but tell me how." And God said, "Water them with love, weed them with firmness, and let them bask in the sunshine of your soul." "Is that all?" "Oh, there is but one thing more. You must remember it is the way you care, the way you touch, that will produce the most precious blossoms. So walk gently among my little ones. Don't step on the pansies." Remembering the words of the master gardener, I go forth to begin my task, whispering this prayer: "O God, give me light words, light hands, light feet, so I won't step on the pansies." Children need to know about abuse. What to do if it happens to them, and to know they will be believed and not be blamed. Simply knowing about abuse does not prevent it. Parents need to learn to be able to talk with their children and to answer their questions about all sorts of things, including abuse, especially sexual abuse. It's important to listen to their entire story and to be aware that telling it is not easy, especially if it disturbs one of their family. The methods employed in telling children about abuse are similar, whether at home, at school, or at a child protection seminar student workshop. At school, your child may learn through the Department of Education child protection curriculum, available in many state and Catholic schools. Many school groups use the Protective Behaviours program. Dipner House in Sydney regularly tours schools in New South Wales with Kids on the Block puppet play. But is this enough? Is it adequate? Here are some rules that I follow in telling children about abuse, and this is the method I use when I run a child protection workshop, the student program, and we've got one of those coming up next Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock. And the fire brigade will be there, the ambulance and police, and they'll all have displays. And we've got an exciting workbook. A sample is there on the table as you go out to see the workbook that we're using. That's this coming Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock. But for now, let me share with you the particular rules that I use in the student workshop, and you're able to employ these same rules in your home if you so choose. Number one, child protection is discussed in the context of other aspects of safety, for example, road and water safety. Number two, emphasis is placed on the importance of touch, good touches, bad touches, what to do when good touching becomes confusing. I believe it's not necessary to give a child detailed descriptions of violent acts of abuse or sexual practices. But if you do discuss private body parts, if you want to use that term, be sure you use the correct terminology. Okay, you talk about breasts as breasts and not boobs and this sort of thing. Make sure you use the correct terminology. Number three, encourage them to inform you if they ever feel yucky or scared for any reason. And tell them you'll believe them. Number four, teach them what to do if they are lost, insecure, or afraid. How to use a telephone, their number, telephone number, their address. Teach them the no, go, tell, stranger danger strategy. Now, I spoke earlier about the myths with regard to stranger danger. But the technique you can follow there is to say no. Even run away and say no if you have to. Go, that is, go away from the situation, flee from it, and tell somebody, a trusted adult. No, go, tell is the strategy there. Number six, teach them when and how to say no. Number seven, teach them the difference between good and bad secrets. Number eight, discuss the names of possible trusted adults. For our daughter's benefit, we have a list of names on the refrigerator with the phone numbers alongside them. And my daughter has memorized the names on that list of people that she can contact, and trusted friends. Pastor's phone number is there. Also the police and ambulance and fire brigade numbers are on that same piece of paper. Number nine is safety house and neighbourhood networks, where they exist. Number 10, and this is so important, and that is to emphasise your love and your concern for your children. Let's move on to protecting your child from abuse. Here are some simple ways that any parent or child giver can teach children to protect themselves from difficult or dangerous situations. People in the child protection field call these protective behaviours. Now, you should have available there a handout, and if you haven't got one, make sure you ask me for it. From the Protective Behaviours Consultancy Group, 77 Elizabeth Street, Waterloo, postcode 2017. Now, I have got some material similar to the sorts of things that you will get from there. This protective behaviours program actually started after I prepared this seminar material, but let me share with you my research in this matter. Protective behaviours give children some simple skills for coping with any difficult or dangerous situation. In particular, they focus on teaching children to recognise when a situation is dangerous and to ask trusted adults for help. Learning protective behaviours and being able to teach them to children is not difficult. So here's some important points to stress. We've got these on overhead. Number one, tell the children they have a right to be safe at all times. Number two, talk to the children about the difference between feeling safe and feeling uncomfortable or scared. Number three, ask the children what sorts of things make them feel safe and happy and what sorts of things make them scared. Now, if you have a look at our booklet we've got on display there for the Child Protection Seminar Student Workshop, you will see that we go into this in detail with our colouring in section of the book. So you ask them what sort of things make them feel safe and happy and what sorts of things make them scared. Number four, encourage your children to trust their feelings. Number five, explain that their own bodies will tell them when they're in danger. For example, they might feel funny in the tummy, or their knees might shake, or they might feel like running away. Everybody's different. Ask the child to tell you how their body feels when it's frightened. And then they can relate that to the situation. Explain that if they don't feel safe, they should tell someone they trust. Tell them that sometimes grown-ups do things that are not okay. Stress that nothing is so awful that they can't tell someone they trust about it. Number nine, explain that sometimes they may tell and the grown-up may not understand or may say, oh, don't be silly, or I don't believe you. If something like this happens, they should keep on telling until someone believes them and does something to help. Although most parents and caregivers hope their children will talk to them first about problems and difficulties, parents cannot always be on the spot when a child needs help. So it's important that children have a network of trusted people they can turn to. Talk to children about this and help them choose a network of at least four people outside the home. Remember that most children are abused by a family member or someone they know, so draw up the network carefully. Let children decide for themselves who they want to invite to be on their network. You might accidentally ask someone the child does not feel comfortable with. Now we're going to stop for a few minutes now, and we've got two short videos that we're going to watch. These are put out by NAPCAN, and one is entitled Safe at Home, and the other one is on Going Home Safely. And we use these videos at our Child Protection Seminar student workshop, amongst others. In fact, at the end of our program, we'll be screening the previews of all the videos we use at the workshop, because I believe that really parents and caregivers should be informed in advance of the material that's being presented to their children at these workshops. And so we're going to have those previews right at the end of our program. But just sit back now. It only takes 15 minutes, and we've got these two videos for us to watch. Okay, now we come back to the next stage in our program, where we're looking at helping the child. Child Protection Council booklet, Child Sexual Assault, How to Talk to Children, gives some very practical advice on what to do when a child tells about sexual assault, so that the act of telling does not become a further ordeal for the child. Now, this is so good that I'm going to share it with you rather than use my own material. Number one. The best ways of helping children are to, one, tell them you believe them. Children rarely lie about or imagine assault. Remember I said earlier that 98% of cases, their statements are found to be true. So you tell them you believe them. Secondly, stress that what happened is not their fault. Thirdly, say you know how hard it was for them to tell. Then do everything you can to comfort and reassure the child. And say you will do everything you can to protect the child, but avoid making promises that you may not be able to keep. Now, you should have a handout on that. Let's move on now. The child's feelings. We're going to look at the different aspects of what the family can do over the next few moments, and other relatives, brothers and sisters and such, but we'll start with the child's feelings. To help us understand the feelings of an abused child, I'm going to use the example of a sexually abused child, and as a discussion and reference points. Other forms of abuse also affect the child in similar ways, but probably to a lesser degree. Finding out that a child has been abused is always a shock. However shocked or angry you may be about it, The feelings of the child are the most important consideration. From the instant a child tells you about the salt, believe and reassure the child. Remain calm, well, at least in front of the child. Doing this will allow the child to feel safe, or safer, which is the first stage in the recovery process. Children who have been abused often live with a feeling of fear, guilt, loneliness, confusion, often for a long time, and when they finally tell, children react in different ways which may baffle adults. The child may be frightened, upset, or may appear calm, cold, and unaffected. It's important for the adult to still react sympathetically, even when the child reacts differently from the way you may expect. To understand a child's feelings, it may help to consider what a child may have been through. For example, in cases of sexual abuse, offenders may have used many threats or tricks to keep the children silent, especially to stop them telling their mother. Offenders may say, "I'll kill if you tell," or "I'll kill your mother," or "you're no good, who would blame you? It'll be your fault if the family breaks up. If you tell, they'll send me to prison." Often in subtle and not so subtle ways, offenders make the child feel responsible for the behaviour of the offender and responsible for keeping it a secret. The mother may feel hurt that the child could not confide, and she believes that there must be something seriously wrong with their relationship or with her. Understanding what the child may have been going through puts a different light on the child's silence or apparent lack of trust. As well as worrying about their family's reactions, children also worry about what other people will think. Will everyone in the street know? Will anyone talk to me? Will they think it's all my fault? Girls worry about being branded bad, and boys worry about people thinking they're gay. These reactions highlight the reasons I suggest that professional counsellors and support be sought in all cases of sexual abuse and considered in other forms of abuse. What about helping the family of an abused child? There is a myth about mothers in that mothers are supposed to be naturally in tune with everything that ever happens to their children, and then therefore they should instinctively know somehow when there's a problem. Let us look at some of the common reactions of mothers and fathers, and in a few moments at other family members. Mothers. For most mothers, the first reaction of shock. One said, "My stomach dropped to the floor. It happens to others, not to your own children." Another mother said to me, "He slept with his own flesh and blood. Who would ever do something like that? How could I ever have imagined such a thing?" For a third, the experience meant, "I can still remember sitting there looking at my cup of coffee until it got so cold that a white glaze formed on the top of the cup. I just sat, not knowing what to do, what to say, where to go. It was like the bottom fell out of my world that morning." Shock. And the initial shock often gives way to anger. "I wanted to put a shotgun to his head. I wanted him to pay, and I still do." Another said, "I wanted to kill him." And sometimes in their confusion, mothers feel angry with the child, falling into the common trap of blaming the victim rather than the offender, coupled with the fact that children sometimes blame their mothers for not protecting him These feelings can lead to an estrangement between mother and child at a time when they need to be close. Professional counselling as soon as possible can help mothers to understand their feelings and to encourage them to direct their anger and energies into positive steps to help the child and to reconstruct their own and their child's shattered lives. Number three, guilt. As the Child Protection Council's booklet, Child Sexual Assault, No Excuses Never Ever, points out, no one but the offender himself is responsible for his actions. Even so, for reasons already mentioned, guilt is still a common reaction from mothers of child victims to sexual assault. Mothers need to be reassured that they do not have to carry this responsibility and allow themselves to be made scapegoats, nor do they have to accept suggestions that they knew or should have known when in fact they did not and could not. Oh, it's ironic. When most people still find the idea of child sexual assault, especially by the child's father, almost unbelievable, they don't seem to see anything contradictory about suggesting that the mother should have suspected her own husband of such a crime. It's like telling a woman to love and trust her husband and leave the children in his care, but at the same time keep an eye on him in case he's sexually assaulting them. The myth that mothers know instinctively must be put to rest. Like everyone else, mothers may feel something's wrong, but don't suspect child sexual assault because they cannot believe it could happen. They don't think of child sexual assault because it is unthinkable. And offenders are generally very good at covering their tracks. As one mother said, I knew something wrong. I knew something was wrong. But I thought he must have had a mistress. One of the main problems with guilt is that once the facts are revealed, hindsight often puts a different light on past events and provides the missing pieces which complete the jigsaw. As one mother put it, I always wondered why he kept getting out of bed at night. Says he couldn't sleep, but wouldn't consider taking sleeping pills. Once this mother knew the truth, she felt guilty that she hadn't worked it out before, but from this sort of evidence, how could she have done so? Fourthly, grief. For most women, discovery that their husband or partner is guilty of child sexual assault brings grief and sadness at two levels. They grieve to think about what has been done to their child, how the child's trust has been betrayed, and how the child has been forced to carry a terrible secret alone. And at the same time, they experience intense grief for the loss of their own relationship with the offender. They are suddenly confronted by a situation which divides their loyalties and calls them to make a choice between their husband or partner and their child. And fifthly, loss. Grief and loss are closely linked. When fathers are the offenders, mothers of child victims of sexual assault lose not only their present peace of mind, but the ability to enjoy happy memories as well. They feel guilty when they remember any good times with the offender, and they begin to question how they could ever have married such a man and see the whole past life with him just as an illusion. The feeling of loss is similar to the loss of a partner through death, except that there is the added bitterness of being denied the happy memories which so often sustain people whose partners have died. Sixthly is confusion. Losing the ability to make sense of the past, mothers are often overwhelmed by confusion and a feeling that the whole wide world has been turned upside down. The discovery of a child sexual assault by a husband or partner is a complete reversal of the romantic dreams with which the relationship began, and which still underpin society's ideal for male and female relationships. Number seven is fear. The fear of mothers of child victims of sexual assault comes out in so many different forms. The often very real fear of violence by the offender, or the fear of having to deal with welfare officers, police, the court system, or the fear of that the child has been irreparably damaged physically or emotionally, a fear that a daughter may be pregnant, a fear that a son may become a homosexual. Many mothers may also experience an overpowering need to keep their children close to them all the time, fearing that more harm will come to them as soon as the child is out of their sight. On top of these emotional burdens, many women also fear poverty and the loss of the family's primary source of income. Those who have not worked for some years and have other children's support often, understandably, lack confidence about becoming a breadwinner. And finally, number 8, isolation. Feeling isolated and different from others is a reaction common to both parents. One mother, who had only recently found out about the sexual assault of her child, described the feeling this way. It is as though there were two worlds, one out there, where everyone is getting along as much as they always do, and one inside me that's full of darkness. This mother said also she was currently feeling there were no bridges from one world to the other. But she knew in time that this feeling would fade. What about dads? Well, dads' feelings are very similar. They too suffer shock, anger, guilt, grief, confusion, a sense of isolation from the rest of the world. But the major difference is that because women are so seldom involved in child sexual assault, fathers do not usually have to face the shock of finding out that their partner is the offender. The father's first reaction is one of shock, especially when they find out their own father or brother, that's the child's grandfather or uncle, or some other close relative or friend is the offender. And after the initial shock, many fathers feel very angry and violent toward the offender who has hurt the child they believe should have been protective. Anger and the urge to take strong action create an illusion of control over the situation. Both shock and anger are, under the circumstances, very natural reactions. They're part of a pattern of grief most parents experience trying to cope with the overwhelming information they've just received. But fathers also feel guilt for what they see as a failure for allowing someone to invade the family's privacy, security, and to harm a member of the family unit. Fathers also grieve for what has happened to their child and are generally very protective, but because men are accustomed to hiding their feelings, many find it difficult to talk about what has happened. Some try to suppress the grief by saying, well, it wasn't as bad as all of that. Or they try to push the problem away from the child by saying, oh, don't make such a fuss, it'll upset the child. Or it's stopped now, let's put it behind us and get on with our lives. Well, in the short term, playing down the significance of child sexual assault may make it easier to handle, but this approach is unlikely to succeed in the long term and certainly not helpful for the child. Loss too is expressed by fathers, loss of their protective powers and authority. It's keenly felt. Especially when their child is living with an ex-wife or partner whose new husband, boyfriend or de facto is the offender. In this situation, the child's father sees this terrible sense of powerlessness because he's unable to be around all the time to protect his child. And finally, for fathers too, is isolation. But the sense of isolation fathers experience is aggravated by the difficulty many men have in discussing their feelings. Admittedly, sexual assault of a child is not an easy subject for anyone to talk about, but especially not for a man who is accustomed to keeping far less intimate problems to himself. Common feeling among men is that counselling is only for women. That doesn't help. Fathers too need someone outside the immediate family with whom they can confide. Now, What about the feelings of brothers and sisters? Brothers and sisters of child victims of sexual assault also experience confusing and conflicting emotions. For example, if the offender is their father and they have not been sexually assaulted by him, they may see themselves as having a perfectly good relationship with him. In their eyes, the child who has broken the silence has also broken the happy home. Younger children often don't understand what has happened and see things only from their own viewpoint. As one boy said of his sister, "I wish she hadn't told. Now I can't play football with Dad anymore." If the other children were fond of both their father and the child victim, their loyalties are divided and they too become very confused. Because they don't completely understand, they sometimes feel jealous that apparently their father preferred one child over another. And this is more likely to happen when the offender has been bribed, or should I say has bribed the child victim, with special favours and with gifts. Okay, we have question time now. Do we have any questions? Yes, there are some things that you can do there. Let me just, we mentioned them earlier on, but I can just revise them now or phrase them slightly differently. Stopping a child, stopping the cycle of child abuse. Yes, you can tell your children you love them and make sure you hug and cuddle your children. Be interested in their lives. Ask them how they feel and what they think. You can praise their talents. If they do something well, make sure you tell them. And children, like all of us, sometimes fail. Nobody can do everything well. So tell them you love them anyhow. And children deserve respect just like adults do. So we need to keep that in mind. Yes, you had a question? Yes, the media does play an important role. I've got an overhead here. Let me just put it on and it might help explain this a little bit. Here's a quote from an extract from The Silent Children by L.T. Stanford. It's a Parent's Guide to Prevention of Child Sexual Abuse. "The media do not encourage us to have sex. They encourage us through sheer volume and overstimulation to view women as things and to think of sex as something devoid of feeling and responsibility. Sexy women are everywhere and they seem to be there for the taking. We tolerate, even encourage men to ogle women's bodies and to treat the person of that body as a sex object. And yet the same man whose attitude towards women is that women exist for his entertainment and prerogative could well be the father of young daughters. Why are we so surprised when his attitude culminates in the sexual exploitation of his daughters?" That was taken from a task force report. It says, "The media plays a crucial role in shaping the myths which abound in the community." I might just mention, you know, that in recent years it's become popular to turn young girl models or actors into child sex symbols. The trend started with Brooke Shields and Jodie Foster, and they've had many imitators, and the portrayal in films and advertising of young girls as objects of sexual interest to adult men is now pretty well commonplace. It's disturbing, really, isn't it? The unrealistic portrayal of children also plays a part in weakening adult inhibitions and encouraging the sexual attraction of adults to children. I'm glad you asked that question because it's important that the community be aware of the impact of the media whether press, radio, television, film, begin asking for a more realistic approach to the portrayal of family life and relationships. The media's already played an important part in increasing community awareness of child sexual assault by showing a willingness to re-examine the images they portray of men, women and children. Still a long way to go before they can make a really positive contribution. Yes, do we have any other questions? Yes, it is difficult to draw a profile of offenders. I'll just give you a quote here from the New South Wales Child Sexual Assault Task Force 1985. It says, attempts at characterising an offender as psychopathic, schizophrenic, poor and underprivileged have failed. Not one thing the vast majority have in common, and that's masculinity. That's rather sobering, isn't it? It sort of narrows it down, but doesn't make it very broad. In looking at the facts about child sexual assault, a picture of who are the most common offenders does emerge, but it still doesn't give us this profile that you asked for. A national study conducted in America in 1981, if I remember rightly, found that 90% of child sexual assault cases were male and 90% of the victims were female. And Australian studies are pretty close to this. I remember in 1984 they had an incest phone-in conducted in Sydney and 99% of the offenders were male and 99% of the victims were female then. And another in 1983 they had a similar phone-in in Adelaide. And in that 97% of offenders were male and 90% were female victims. And so I guess the reports from those give us some sort of insights into what the victims were like. I should have that list here, just one moment. I've got, here we are. The Sydney Survey 1984, 57% were fathers, 12% were uncles, 10% were brothers, 6% were stepfathers, 5% were grandfathers, 1% were a male cousin, 1.5% were a live-in de facto male, 1.2% were a brother-in-law, 0.9% mother, 0.3% a male legal guardian, 0.3% a son or mother's boyfriend, 0% was stepmother, de facto male, sister-in-law, male or female legal guardian, grandmother, female cousin or other. So you can see that more than half in that Sydney survey the offenders were fathers. In the Adelaide survey it was almost half, 42%, and 15% actually were a male acquaintance, which included friends of the child's family, neighbours, mothers, boyfriends and male acquaintances with the family through employment. So predominantly it's this significant other in the family, if it's not indeed the father. Thank you for that question, yes. Do we have any other questions? Yes, in response to your question with regard to the effects of divorce on a child, the National Health and Medical Research Council actually puts out a publication, and from memory it's The Effects of Family Breakup on Children, and that is available free of charge from the National Health and Medical Research Council. It was the Child Health Committee that put it together. Yes, they emphasise four segments of divorce in that publication. They have a pre-divorce period they talk about, which is characterised by increasing emotional disharmony between the marriage partners. And then there's the divorce itself, if you like. This is breaking the bond, when the case is heard in the family court and decisions are made regarding the division of the matrimonial property, maintenance payments, custody of the children, access by the non-custodial parent, these sorts of things. And then there's the post-divorce phase, when family members must accommodate themselves to the altered social, economic, psychological realities of a broken home. And then there's another stage which we often forget even exists, and that's this phase of final adjustments and stabilisation of lifestyles. And if there's uncertainties and arguments about the payment of maintenance and the custody of children, access and these sorts of things, these last two phases, the post-divorce phase and the phase of final adjustments, the stabilisation of lifestyles, becomes very prolonged. And consequently, there's a list of things that were listed in that booklet, if I remember, that are highlighted when this phase is prolonged. There is the family conflict which precedes the divorce. It appears more damaging to the children than the divorce itself. And the divorce to a child represents a relief from family tension and an opportunity to make a fresh start. Only in exceptional circumstances, of course, is divorce not followed by a reduction in living standards, especially for the mothers and the children. And if the lifestyle is not socially constricted, it may have a greater impact on the child's development than broken family relationships would. The age and sex and previous experiences of the child will influence his reactions. Preschool children, for example, may be upset by separation from constant parent figures and the lack of constant parenting. Adolescents may criticise their parents' behaviour and respond to a lack of supervision by their activities. Friends of their own age who are able to give emotional support can do much to mitigate this. Boys generally show more disturbance than girls. This probably results from a lack of male companionship if they remain with a single female parent, since their difficulties often improve if a sympathetic stepfather enters the home. Grief, well, except for the very young, all children will experience a grief reaction, often accompanied by feelings of guilt, lest they've contributed to the rift in any way. A period of mourning is necessary for them to come to the fact that the parent's separation is final. This is individual to each child and may take considerable time for the children to work through their grief. Distress, common feelings of anxiety, miserable or often parent present. Children act out the anger they feel towards one or the other parent through antisocial behaviour. Often settles down after about a year. The most important determinants of a satisfactory outcome relate to the predictable family routines and reliable access arrangements with the non-custodial parent. And finally, many children, especially younger ones, fail to comprehend the meaning of what's happened. Simple explanations as to what the divorce entails and what arrangements are being made for family members to see one another can often alleviate this insecurity. Well, thank you for your time of taking the effort to come out this evening. It's been a very cold evening, but I think we've had a very fruitful time together. And we'll see you with your children on Saturday afternoon, 3 p.m. at our student workshop. Thank you for coming.